HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/BIZ.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
Hello and welcome to Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Chef Adrian Lipscomb, a Texas native and the owner of Uptown Cafe and Bakery in Wisconsin. She's a very busy woman, so in addition to being a business owner, she's also a wife, a mother of four, a city planner, and the founder of the newly launched 40 Acres and a Mule project, which she created in June to preserve, research, and celebrate Black foodways. On today's show, we talk about the goals of the project and the importance of legacy, which Adrian shares from her own personal familial stories about cooking with her aunts and mother. And she shares it from the point of view of being a Black culinarian who is invested in passing along knowledge about Black foodways to the next generation of Black chefs. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and I hope that you consider supporting the 40 Acres and a Mule project. Adrian's raised $82,000 so far, and the goal is $100,000 in the next couple of weeks. So if you want to support, head to GoFundMe/F/40Acres Project, and you can also go on Instagram. It's at 40 Acres Project there. And you can also head to HungrySociety.com. where I'll post a story about this episode in particular, and I'll be sure to link to all of Adrian's social handles so you can support. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Thank you so much. Adrian, thank you so much for being on A Hungry Society.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I am such a fan of, I was about to say your work, but I think it extends to just your general presence.
Oh my goodness.
I think the first time we met was at the Beard House. The dinner that you did, Rahana was there, Chef Therese Nelson was there, and it was about Southern traditions, and it was absolutely beautiful.
Well, yes, you know, that's my family, you know, people that came there, that were helping me cook. They were family. You know, I didn't look at them as a partnership. We just knew what to do and how to work together. So it just made the night, you know, magnificent.
Yeah. And the dish that you made was Mexican, if I remember like correctly.
Yeah. So I'm from San Antonio, which has a huge population of Hispanic, and my family has some descent from Mexico. And this was just something that I know how to make, in that it's just custom, like fresh tortillas. You know, we were making Oaxacan sauce. And so it just worked. It is just something that I wanted to introduce, but also I wanted to let people know that my culture goes more than just being African American, but it goes deeper when we start talking about location and where you're from in the South.
Mm. Yeah. The dish was, can you tell listeners about the dish that you made that evening?
Yeah, so I made a mocajete, which was really infused deep with chiles that were brought from Texas. And it's a deep chili sauce that was slow cooked with beef shank. And it takes a couple hours to make it. And usually it's served in a mocajete, so in more like a mortar and pestle, like a like the like the mortar and pestle. And it's usually served super, super, super hot. And then we made tortillas. So Rahana, Chef Rahana, helped me make the tortillas because she does also have in her heritage as being Latina, also an African-American.
Mm. Oh, my goodness. That's so beautiful. I'm just like picturing you and Rahana making these tortillas together. Oh, man. It's just like, it's like in soft focus in my brain. It's just like very, very like beautiful in my head. So what led you to becoming a chef?
So I always cooked. I've been cooking since I was 8. It was one of those things that my mom wanted to make sure that we knew how to do. But I was also a latchkey kid. So being able to come home and make your own food. You know, I still remember making my first meal, which was a hamburger. And my family sat around and bit into a raw hamburger, you know. So at being 8 years old, trying to make food. But my family has always centered around eating. So with my grandmother sitting around the table, watching her cook in her kitchen, just the influence of always cooking. And how mostly I became a chef was under stress, stress of your day job, stress at going to school at the same time, just stress of life. And I just started cooking. And I guess I made too much food for people because they were like, here, take my money.
And then,
good at it. So they were like, please, I want to pay you. Yeah, they were like, here, please just take your money. And it really started with caramels. I started making caramels. Mm. And one of the things I do have is I have a high sense of taste and smell. And so I started making unique things. And people were like, okay, this, I feel really bad. You keep making wonderful food. I feel like I need to pay you. And then I started investing into looking at how to create a business. And then I opened my first bakery in Austin, Texas.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. Speaking of cooking under stress, I read that you cooked for 500 or 600 protesters at Standing Rock.
Yes. So that was quite interesting. So that's by the time I moved up to Wisconsin. I probably was here for about 3 months, and Standing Rock was happening at the same time. And, you know, demographically, I didn't even know where it was located at until I Googled it and saw that it was like 9 hours away. I really wanted to go, but at the time I was 8 months pregnant and my husband said, no, you are not going to have a baby at Standing Rock. one of my, two of my friends were going to Standing Rock and they were invited by the Sioux Indian community to cook for Thanksgiving. And I offered for them for a place to stay when, if they were coming my way, in which they were. They let me know that they were cooking for about 1,000 people and they were making soup. And I said, well, I want to do something. And they told me, no, you're doing enough. And I was like, no, I'm going to do something. I'm going to make bread rolls. And when they told me 1,000, I was just like thinking, gosh, everybody usually eats more than one piece of bread. It's a bread roll, you know, okay, I'm going to make 2,000. And, you know, mind you, I was really new to the community of La Crosse, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I needed help. So I just asked on my social media, if anybody is interested in making bread rolls, please meet me at the commercial kitchen at 8 a.m. And I did not know who was going to walk in that door, but literally the community walked in at 8 o'clock, and I had 32 people walk in and started making bread rolls. Wow. So every hour I would look up and I would count people, and we were way over 30 to 40 people that would show up. We had people who had never made bread in their life. We had dough makers that were for pizza makers that were there. We had wives that brought their husbands and were like, you're going to do something, you know? So it varied. And I think our youngest one was like 4 and our eldest was like 92. And, you know, as the day went on, we finished the rolls by 11:30, and everybody's like, well, what do we do? And I said, well, I'm going to be here till 5. And so we just bought more supplies and made more rolls. And wow. So by the time we were done, we made about 5,000 rolls. And also we still had people coming in the door and they were like, oh, all the bread's made. They started cleaning up. They started mopping the floor, wiping off the counters, doing dishes. And so, you know, I really knew that I was in the right place, that I was living in the right town.
Wow. That's amazing. And like, what a, like, yeah, like it's such a great introduction to this community that you're now a part of, you know, like that's really beautiful.
Yeah, it still is amazing. I still get chills just thinking about it, and about all the community that we just moved here. So it was less than 3 months. It was right after Trump was elected. Wisconsin had just turned red, and my grandmother was like, come home. And I was like, yeah. Grandma, you live in Texas.
Yeah, you live in Texas.
So, in red. Yeah, it's been red. So it has been it was such a great introduction into meeting the community and understanding, who they are and their beliefs and faith and helping others. That, like I said, it really just kind of cemented that we were in the right city.
Mm. So, I mean, just like from the little bit we've been talking, it sounds like there's so many influences in your cooking. Like, how do you describe your style of cooking as a chef? Like, if someone asked you what your style of cooking is, like, how would you answer that?
That's so interesting, because I've been thinking about like what exactly is my style. And, I do have a huge Southern heritage and a huge Southern background, but I have such a particular interest to new food and new ways of cooking. So, I do say I do cook Southern food. A lot of people mainly know that I do pastries, but I do have an influx of doing Southern food. I've loved French food. I do make some Indian food. I do, cook Oaxacan. I mean, it's just a variation of different types, but mainly people seek me out, especially for Southern style.
Mm. Yeah. And I can't believe we haven't mentioned Uptown Cafe and Bakery yet. Can we talk about your restaurant and I guess what it's like right now and what this moment has been like for you?
Yeah, so it's been really interesting because, when we moved here and we opened up a brick and mortar, it was under different circumstances, as you know. The area that I chose to be in and worked with the community in was going through revitalization. And so my background spans into architecture. So I have my bachelor's and master's in architecture, and I am a PhD candidate in community regional planning, for short, city planning. So about revitalization is huge, and working within the community is huge in my studies. And so we decided that if we were going to open a space, that this space would be a community impact space. So it's not going to be a third space that you just come to on the way home or you catch a meeting at, but it would be impactful in use for the community. So before we opened the doors, we invited a couple of my friends that were in planning and, an economic development planner, a public space, a public art planner, and asked the community what did they really want in this area, like trying to help find their voice. And, worked with the city itself to help do beautification, put trees, paint light poles, just fix up and spruce the area up. And then it just became contagious. Businesses started opening. We were probably about 40% occupied. Now we're about 100% occupied now.
Wow.
And a lot of women-owned businesses, in fact, are off our street now. So it became contagious in that people wanted to be involved and wanted to be in this area. So the cafe is a Southern restaurant. It is the only Southern restaurant in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We really do focus highly on working with farmers because of the area that I'm in. The area really is known as for organic. So it's more the Organic Valley area. So Organic Valley is not too far from me. The company is not too far from the city. And the terrain is not flat. It is very hilly. We have a lot of bluffs. And having that terrain makes it to the point that you can't take big machinery over. So most of the farmers out here are organic. So we try to work one-on-one with farmers. So at any given time, you may see a farmer haul in and bring something into the restaurant. We work with a beef co-op. We work with different farmers and around the area that specialize in certain products. And we just try to bring a little bit of flair from the South up to the Midwest. They try to grow some things that you know, I'm not used to, you know, that I usually can get in the South that you can't get up here, like okra. That's one of the things that was like a teaching lesson for people.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, those are things that they don't usually grow in this area. But I'm also, it has allowed me to expand the palate and look at things that I'm not used to having fresh. You know, our berry season's a little bit longer. Ramps are available. Rhubarb is available. Mm. You know, just certain ingredients that I usually don't get. And how can I adapt them and add them into some Southern recipes?
Wow. When you were talking about how things come into the restaurant, like straight from direct from the farm, it reminded me of this restaurant I worked at in Boston where I was a manager at this restaurant, and we would get heritage pigs, half a pig or so, like every couple of weeks, because we had like an in-house charcuterie program. And the kitchen at this place was super tiny. It was like a converted townhome. And so sometimes half the pig would have to sit, it was wrapped up loosely, but it would be like, it'd have to sit on the edge of the bar until the chefs made space for it to hang in the walk-in. And people would, you know, we were open all day for lunch and dinner, and people would be so curious about it, but like also kind of freaked out, but also kind of excited that they were like seeing this part of the process. And it was just like, I don't know, it just made me think of that like story. I haven't thought about that in years.
Yeah. And so same here. We work with our farmers, and, you know, we have one place, Rainbow Ridge, grows our pigs for us, and it's really a goat farm, but they have also, they do a set of heritage pigs, and they feed them goat's milk. So, you know, we have like a really unique opportunity when we work, you know, individually with different farmers, you know, and so we go through that whole process of having to go pick up our own pigs too after they're processed. So, you know, this, the whole experience is great, but we also like to do it a little bit further. Like we'll do farmer to table. So we'll have like a special dinner, and we'll invite the farmer to come to that dinner where his produce is being used.
Wow.
And he's able to talk to who eats it on the regular. And I mean, it's amazing to see the questions that come from it, and also the opportunities for others to get product from the farmer too.
Yeah, it's so funny how you were so disconnected usually from the things we eat, the meat we eat, the produce that we eat, like so disconnected that like people get, I love what you said, like farmer to table. Like, I think most people never ever get to like talk to a farmer who actually grows their food.
Yeah, I mean, other than probably the farmer's market, they may get an opportunity to talk to them, but to have to be able to sample and eat it with them in cooked form that the chef has done, to see, you know, you see both worlds. So you see the farmer getting to try their product that they never get to try in the form that the chef has put it in, but also you have, you know, we call them our community, who are also getting to eat that product but with the farmer, and be able to talk about the product and how it grows and where it comes from. I mean, our best one we had is when we had the co-op for the beef farm come in, and we had like 6 courses of beef. So,
wow.
You know, it sold out so
six
quickly.
Courses.
Yeah, it was 6 courses of beef, but, you know, but they were able to ask about, you know, where their cows are bred, where they're from, you know, what it takes for them to do certain cuts, where a certain cut comes from, because a lot of people didn't even know where a certain cut came from. So it was just it's a wonderful experience just to make the connection a little bit closer.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're like super embedded in the culinary community in Wisconsin. I'm curious the differences you've noticed between growing up in the South, in Texas, in San Antonio, and with the foodways in Wisconsin. Like, what are some of the differences you noticed in how people eat in both places?
You know, what's so interesting about being up north is that we're closer to a lot of manufacturing and processed food. So there is a high set of processed food within this area. Mm-hmm. I think me growing up in Texas, I just led the way of eating less processed food, getting fresh fruits and vegetables, working, you know, going to the farmer's market. But, you know, also my bakery was at the farmer's market. So I was able to create those types of connections that I had for years. And then also, you know, my own garden, and I had my own aquaponic system in my backyard, bees and chickens. So, you know, I was really in depth into, you know, eating from the land as much as possible. So when we moved up here, it was like starting all over again. What has been really that helpful thing is that social media has helped me out so much. Is when I'm looking for a product, I can put it on my social media, and I would probably say within 2 hours, I will have a contact. Wow. Or that product will be sitting at my table already. I like from a farmer who has dropped it off. And so the clear, closer connections due to being in a smaller city, everybody knows everybody. And so, you know, they don't even tell me who told them. They say, they'll even say, someone told me that you were looking for this, and I'll get a phone call at the restaurant, and I'll be like, wow, I just put something out on social media not even 10, 15 minutes ago. But it's all, you know, it's really interesting because I'll talk about it and my friends are like, oh, just, you know, you're so lucky, you just do it on social media. Let's see if you get it. And most of the time I do get it.
Wow. That's really awesome. That's really cool. So speaking of social media, I want to chat about the 40 Acres and a Mule project, which I read that the genesis of that was people sending you money anonymously, like just, you know, sending you sums of money through social media or through Cash App or whatever.
Yeah, it was quite strange. It really started, it started before receiving the money, because I'm known to go into Black food folks on the IG live and, you know, and get to be with, you know, everyone, all different chefs. And mm-hmm. Someone had brought up the conversation that they had received a Venmo of money from a stranger, a white female. And she just commented that she liked what she was doing and she wanted to help and send money. And her, she had a little complication, like, why should I accept this money? I thought it was kind of funny. And I said, huh, really strange. And the next day I went to work, and things are a little old fashioned here. We still receive letters. I received a letter, and it was a card with a check. And it was just signed the person's name, and it said, keep dancing. It was just a little card. And I was like, I don't know what this is. Did I, you know, I'm like, did I have a catering gig I didn't know about? Did I, you know, I'm trying to figure out where this money came from. And I just put it away. It was like out of sight, out of mind. I'll figure it out. Well, the following day, I received a message asking for my Venmo to send me money for emotional labor, because I was writing on my Facebook about Minneapolis and what was happening, and trying to relate more of an educational piece about race and racism. And this came from a fellow peer. And I started realizing, like, you know, why are you sending, you know, like, why are you sending me money? What is this for? Is this for white guilt? Is this for, you know, something that you would like to support? Or should I be doing something? Literally, I'm thinking, should I really be doing something? And I think with that message, I kind of shut down for the night, and I went to sleep, and I was like, I can't handle anything else. I woke up the next morning with such clarity of what I was going to do. I said, I'm going to take the money, and then I'm going to buy Black land. And that was under the presence of, like, since I've worked with so many farmers, a majority of my farmers are white, or, you know, and I don't have any that are Black. And when you start looking at the numbers of rural farmers, there is less than 1% of Black farmers in the United States, period. and the numbers dwindling down. And when you think about the effect of COVID on agriculture and what we're going through right now, it's really severe because it was planting season and people are taking a gamble on their planting and what they're putting into the ground. And so assuming that a lot of Black farmers are also suffering along with our majority of our farmers. The next question goes, okay, if you buy land, how much land do you buy? And I'm a history buff and I love reading about history. And I said, well, why don't we buy 40 acres and a mule? And if this is possible. So by that time, you know, I'm thinking, you know, it's like 6 a.m. I'm like, who's awake on the East Coast and who can I talk to? Because they've been up for an hour, you know, and started making calls and started going over this idea of the, you know, buying this land. And you think about what is it for? And I'm like, my word this year has been legacy. And I was like, well, how can we preserve Black foodways in agriculture, but also in hospitality? Because as you know, at the time, the pivotal time, there was a lot of angst and conversation about what was happening with race and racism within the hospitality realm. And so I decided to say, what if we concentrate on Black agriculture and figuring out who's out there still left, who's out there? And then if we could gather or interview these Black farmers and collect their traditional ways of planting, and if we can kind of copy that on the land, if we can just start recording this, and if we record it by vocal, or if we videotape it, or if they draw, you know, what are those aspects that we can start collecting this history so we can preserve it? And then I started thinking about, like, well, what about our foodways? Who's collecting menus now? Who is collecting all of our information? I know that it's kind of sparsed everywhere across the United States. In some exhibits, it usually comes out on Black History Month, you know. But there's no space in which you where it's just being held. And then how can we connect these two together, as they are one, really, and they've really been treated separately? And I said, well, what if we had a building on the land that had the entertainment or cooking space to cook the product off the land? So from the teaching of the methods of growing it to being able to use it to teach education with it. And I said, this could be bigger than I think. That's what I was thinking at the time. And as of today, it is a lot bigger than what I was thinking it was.
Which is a blessing. It's such a blessing.
It is a blessing. To me, it, you know, also, you know, you'll see on my IG or on 40 Acres Project, you'll see a history pop up of, and like I said, I'm a history buff. A history buff about the agriculture portion of our influence and what Black people influence in agriculture. And it is huge. And these are things that people don't know. These are farmers don't even know that we influence a lot of what's today that is happening, especially in sustainability.
Absolutely. And speaking of this project, there was this gorgeous piece written by Angela Burke about it and how you were celebrating Juneteenth. And there's for Food and Wine, which I'll make sure I post the link so that people can read it. But you have this gorgeous quote that I want to read to you about the project and some of the ways in which you hope it has an impact. You said, "I want to leave stepping stones for others to move forward. If we're able to move the wheel a little bit, or move it a little faster for our children to have an easier time to get education, to get access to food, to get access to land ownership, I'm going to try my damnedest best to get towards that for them." I thought that was so beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I stopped thinking about myself a long time ago, and especially when I had my first kid. I realized right off the bat, I'm not here for myself anymore. I'm here for the future and that legacy and laying that foundation for the next stepping stone to be able to teach. That's one reason why Rahana was there for our dinner. Mm-hmm. It's not for me anymore. It's to be able to teach these ways, and, you know, and then when I'm gone, that these ways keep growing. And especially for land ownership. And I believe, you know, that was really instilled by my great grandfather. He bought land, and he had a lot of land, and he purchased for his kids. And so when he passed away, each kid had a piece of land, you know, unbeknownst to him, but he passed away at 99. So his kids didn't get the land till, you know, they're in their 60s and their 70s. But, you know, the shock and awe of the fact that he wanted to make sure his kids were always taken care of. And, you know, same thing for, I believe it just was ingrained, because when we had our first kid, first thing I did within the first 6 months was like, I have to buy a house. Like, mm-hmm. I have to own land. It just felt like I needed to secure not my place, but my child's place in this world. Because if anything had happened to me, my child would be okay. Mm. And I think that's what you can see it a lot in the history about land ownership and black people owning land. It wasn't just about the ownership of it, but it was about the freedom. It was about right. community. It was also about economics and how you were able to profit off the land also. Mm.
Yeah, it's well, what you're talking about with the project too, it's so much about, it's like documentation and space, right? It's ownership in many right. different ways, like not just for you, not just for your children, but for a culinary community that hasn't had the opportunity to really be documented in full humanity the way we should have been.
Right. And I mean, and if you see in history of the standpoint and you start thinking about the emancipation of how we were all just freed, what were we supposed to do? Right. Where were we supposed to go? And when the states and the government tried to give us land, or were giving us pieces of land, or the 40 acres and mule, it was taken away. And it was given back to the original landowners, or sometimes to the masters. They were given those pieces back that were taken away during the war. So I think at the beginning, you know, we knew land ownership meant something. That it meant part of our freedom. It meant the ownership of owning something, that you started to have an identity in this world.
Mm. And no one could tell you how to use your land or what to do on it. I mean, you know, of course, Black folks' safety and security has always been like negotiated in this country. But in theory, when you have full ownership, you get to, you know, spread your arms a bit and really like express yourself and enjoy your land the way you want to.
Right. But it also talks about, you know, as you're getting older, you know, what your land turns into, what happens to your land. Mm-hmm. Do you buy more land? Do your children live closer to you on this land? Like the generations of what's happening. So it goes really deep within our culture about land ownership and trying to achieve land. So when we're talking reparations, and, you know, the word comes up a lot, especially with 40 acres and a mule, what does that look like today? Mm-hmm. And I'm about to put my city planner hat on for you real quick. you know, we're starting to talk about affordable housing and housing itself. So imagine if you didn't have to pay for your housing, if you didn't have to pay a mortgage or mm-hmm. rent or lease. What does that look like? Right. What would you do? How would your quality of life change? So those are those things that we start thinking about, especially about ownership and land ownership, is like you start finding your place and your identity over what you will do with your life, what will happen to your property. You start thinking beyond just the moment now and start thinking the future.
Right. So you launched a crowdfunding campaign. On what day?
Oh my gosh. Oh gosh. You're going to test me with this. I'm like, everything's so such a blur. So June 7th.
Wow.
I will say June 7th. We launched on June 7th.
And currently how much have you raised?
Oh gosh. I don't even know, because I don't look. I feel like I jinx it.
Does it make you anxious to look?
I do get anxious to look, and it's really funny because my best friend and my husband, they'll text it to me, and I would be like, I text numbers back to them, and they're like, what are these numbers? And I said, they're each other's phone numbers. I'm like, go talk to each other.
Right.
I can't handle it. And I think one of the reasons is because I'm such a doer. I have like, I'm in a tunnel and I'm doing this, you know, I know in my heart and my bones that I feel we'll make it, you know, maybe we'll go over it, but I know we're going to make it. I can't concentrate at the number coming in. I need to concentrate on getting to where we need to go.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking at it right now. I won't say the number. I'll say it in the intro that I'm going to record later. So that way you don't have to hear it.
No, it's okay. But, I'll probably hear it by the end of the day. I promise you.
So I'm going to make sure that I post a link so that listeners can support, you know, and give money to the GoFundMe. But what are some other ways that listeners can support you, Chef Lipscomb?
Oh my gosh. You know, it's not just supporting me. There's other programs and organizations out there too that are doing some of the same work that I am doing. And like I said, and you said it before, you know, I am just trying to make the wheel go a little bit faster. I'm not trying to recreate it. Mm-hmm. There's other opportunities if by far of interest that are out there that deal with Black agriculture that works with helping other farmers maintain their land or purchase land, which, you know, is also good. But also just, you know, if you can share, you know, share mm-hmm. our campaign is one of the big things that we want people to know, because we are also educating at the same time. So like, you know, that history buff of information, we're pushing a lot of that information out there so people can really see the history of Black Foodways and how Black Foodways has really helped lay some of the foundations of where our food comes from today, agriculturally, and just your food on your plate.
Mm. It's really beautiful. And big picture wise, I mean, that's a very big picture, but even bigger picture, what do you hope to accomplish in like 10 years with your cooking, with the 40 Acres and the Mule project, with anything? I'm curious, like, what does 2030 Chef Adrian hope to have accomplished?
Well, I hope my kids are out the house, which only one will be.
I'm sure quarantine has been rough. But you said four kids?
I have four kids.
Wow.
My youngest is 4 months, so was just born right before quarantine started. And my eldest right now is 14. You know, what I hope for in 10 years is transparency and honesty within our culture, really acknowledging our past and really trying to fix the wrongs that that has happened to us and generations before us. Food-wise, I think there needs to be a huge balance within hospitality of understanding of cultures and race and giving us a seat at the table, or, you know, we're going to end up making our own table and, you know, inviting you to the table. I think you're going to see a lot of that type of impact happening in the next couple of years. I hope to... Myself, I really hope to not just bring this project to a fruition, but really start bringing it forward that people pick it up and they start moving forward beyond what I'm capable of doing or my vision alone to help expand the knowledge of not just in Black food, but for other cultures too.
Yes, I'm really trying to get people to understand that Black history is American history. It's not an other, it's not a different category. And it's, you know, it's, I think we should start looking at it that way. Like, this is all part of a big story about this country.
Oh, yes, most definitely. And it needs to stop being treated as something that's separate, and that it needs to be start to be incorporated in our history that we are, that we have now. And I think, you know, especially within hospitality, that we need to start looking at our culture and our food as good as any other culture's food, you know, or even for fine dining. I mean, our food deserves to be on fine china too, and it deserves to be, you know, treated with respect. And that I think one thing that's amazing about our foodways is that it is so diverse, and it is across the spectrum of service that we have. It is probably one of the oldest ones that have advanced to where we are today, and has been the most flexible of change, but also has kept deep root in its history.
Yeah, it's dynamic, it's evolving, it's still evolving and changing, and it's a beautiful thing for me as like a food writer, a beautiful thing to document. And I'm sure the cook as well for you.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, and I'm happy and I'm blessed to be a part of it.
Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more with Chef Adrian Lipscomb.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee, representing 75% of U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry production. With over 100 articles published in health journals stating the vast health benefits of Michigan superfruits, it's best to choose the cherry with more. U.S. Montmorency Tart Cherries. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency Tart Cherry at choosecherries.com.
All right, so we are back with Chef Adrian Lipscomb. I want to know about any early dining traditions you have. Like, were there any like set family traditions when it came to like eating dinner or any other meal of the day?
You know, we did some weird things, and, you know, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s. And so, you know, like every other Friday was payday. And so, you know, you had your pizza dinner, we would have pizza. But my mom,
pizza?
Which pizza? Favorite. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I enjoyed Pizza Hut.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the 90s. Favorite. Yeah. It was Pizza Hut. And then, you know, Little Caesars was like the square pizza. It was all about square. Cause I was like, what, a new shape. I can handle this. But yeah, we had pizza. Another thing that my mom would do is when she would pick us up when we were kids, she would like take us to Albertsons. And I don't know if y'all know that grocery store, and they would make hot, fresh bread like every hour. Oh, wow. And my mom would buy like a stick of butter and bread. And then she would take us to, we live kind of close to like the lake and the ocean. And she would take us to the lake and we would eat bread and we would feed pieces to the ducks. So this is like probably between the age of like 5 and 8, five and seven, my mom would do this. And you know, other traditions that we would make, like I said, I started cooking at 8 and I just continued to cook. So we did eat dinner at the dinner table, for dinner. And to me, it was just common. It wasn't that we sat in front of a TV and we ate, we always sat at the dinner table and ate. So I didn't know anything about, oh, you can eat and watch TV at the same time until I was like high school. I was like, what? I didn't know this was possible. you know, it was mainly that we always sat around the table and we ate together. Tradition was my sister didn't cook. She doesn't cook. And so we didn't allow her to cook any food. And she'll probably say she's a good cook now, but no, we still don't. We don't let her cook at all. Traditionally wise, I started probably making the Thanksgiving dinner around 13. So it was always my mom, you know.
Wow.
Making the Thanksgiving dinner. And then by the age of 13, I kind of just said, I want to do it. And I just kind of took over doing the Thanksgiving dinner for now on.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, at 13.
At 13, yeah. And then for my grandmother, just traditionally, if you go to my Nana's house, there's always a sour cream pound cake. If she knows that you're coming, and if there's not, there's always cookies. So you literally come through the garage, you come straight from the garage, straight into the kitchen. You're saying hi, Nana, but you're looking on top of the refrigerator, looking for the cake. Like, there's no eye contact to her until you see if there's cake. And if there's no cake, you go to cookies and then you look at her. She already knows. She knows that affair. But it's always remembering the Sunday dinner at my grandmother's house. And during the summer, because we would go back home during the summer to Texas, and remembering her, you know, ironing, getting ready for church, and, you know, listening to gospel music, you know, ironing clothes in her slip, you know, making sure bread was getting started and dinner was cooking slowly before we went to church. And so when we came home, you know, early dinner was ready, and she would prepare our plates and such. It was always been around the table. My grandmother's table was the number one thing. We didn't sit in the living room. No, she had the plastic on her couch.
I bet that it got hot too in the summer.
Oh, we didn't sit on the couch. We weren't allowed to sit on the couch. No, ma'am. I don't even think we really ventured into the living room or the parlor space. We mainly stayed within the kitchen and the dining room because they were connected. And so there was a TV in the dining room area. It wasn't on when we ate, but that's kind of where we stayed. So when you go over our house, you sat at the dining room table. All of our conversations have been around that dining room table. In fact, it's the same dining room table since I was a little kid.
Wow.
Yeah. So, oh my gosh, these memories. But, you know, like I said, it's always circled around food, the understanding of food. I mean, I can go back to my great grandmother, my grandmother James, and it was always, she was in the kitchen cooking, preserving, you know, remembering going to go grab the peach preserves because she made biscuits, you know, sitting around their smaller table with my great grandfather, you know, talking and eating and going outside to the garden. Yeah, it's just my whole life has been just surrounded by food.
Wow. And that's very, very lucky. You know, I talk to a lot of people and they don't necessarily have that connection to our food memories like that. And I think, you know, you said your word of the year is legacy. And, you know, you just described a food legacy that you've been given around multiple tables. And it sounds like a lot of matriarchs as well, like, it giving you this like beautiful food legacy to carry on.
It's quite amazing because my mom was the only girl in her family from my grandmother, but my grandmother had plenty of sisters, and so all her sisters were my aunts. I never called them my great aunts. So they, you know, I watched them growing up. You know, I had they had nicknames or their names were around food. Like, I had an Aunt Cookie. You know, I had an Aunt Joy, but her nickname was Butch because, you know, she butchered food. So she never cooked. So, you know, we had like,
you know, I thought you meant like she was a butcher.
No, she wasn't a butcher. She just butchered food. So, I mean, my memories around food, like when I would stay with my Aunt Butch, she couldn't cook. And she was the first one to ever take me to like a big box store, like a Sam's or a Costco. And she would be like, okay, get what you're going to eat for the summer.
Oh, wow.
Because she didn't cook, but she could make a mean root beer float, you know, like, she, you know, and so that was like my first time ever having a Hot Pocket, you know, so it's like having these little experiences of, you know, when you're small and just the little memories and the fond memories of doing things together and that surrounded food and hearing the stories about food. My grandmother was the cookbook editor of the church cookbook, and, you know, and she gave all her granddaughters copies of those books, and, you know, and we still use them today. Wow. That was probably the only written cookbooks that have family recipes in it, because we all did them orally, so you only knew verbal of what these recipes were. And if you like, if I called today and I would be like, hey, was that a tablespoon or a teaspoon? They would tell me, I don't know. And they would do it on purpose because, and then they would say, it looks like you haven't been home enough.
Oh, wow.
And you would have to go home and you would have to cook it with them. To learn again. And you'd be like, darn it, it was a freaking teaspoon. And then you wouldn't tell me that over the phone, you know, and it was, but rightfully so, you know, if I'm forgetting these legacies or these memories of these recipes, they're putting me back in it. And they're working with me. They're talking to me. We're creating a new history and we're making it together and we're testing it together.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. So to switch gears a little bit, to bring it to the present moment, how are you staying inspired? Like, what are you watching, listening to, reading right now?
Oh my gosh, it's been a whirlwind of adventures. You know, I am a huge music buff. And so, you know, Pandora has saved my life. And so has Spotify. You know, I've been listening to like a Jill Scott mix. And when I got to get real work done, it's that Cardi B mix as well.
Oh my goodness. Okay, Meg Thee Stallion.
And Meg Thee Stallion.
So yes. Much work done because I'm so hyped up at my desk.
Yeah, so Megan Thee Stallion gets me too. You know, movie wise, I started watching The Watchmen recently because I haven't seen of it with Regina King. So I've been watching a little bit of that, but I'm having to take breaks because like the first episode was about the Tulsa massacre. So I needed I needed a couple days. In book wise, you know, I am reading Freedom Farmers by Dr. Monica White.
Yes, absolutely. Former guest of the show.
Right. I just got Jessica B. Harris's new book with her postcards. I just recently got that one. And you know, I have so many books that have little tips that I'm reading in there. Chris Hayes, who's a chef down in New Orleans who grills oysters, just did a self-publishing of his book. I just got that book. So, you know, I kind of just look all over for certain reads. I'm rereading some books on race and racism and planning because I thought, you know, hey, I'm not going to need these books for a while, but oh yes, I need those books. So, you know, a plethora of books that are out. So, you know, it's a dive in, a dive out. I just recently got the African American 200 Years of Cookery. I believe that's the title of the book.
Oh wow!
I just got that book yesterday. So, you know, I dive in and it's quite interesting. I kind of leave books in certain areas, and my husband gets kind of upset because there are books everywhere, but when I have a free moment, I pick up a book and I'm like, oh yes, I started on this one. Let me read this. Just that impact of, you know, just wanting to grasp so much knowledge and wanting to read about where things come from and, you know, why we think a certain way and how did we get to this recipe or how did we get here? It fills me with joy to have a better understanding of our world and our food.
Yeah. I feel you on the books everywhere thing. So my husband has a degree in creative writing. And so, and I'm constantly doing the same thing, like picking things up and, you know, we have bookshelves on bookshelves and my desk is covered in books and magazines. And that's not even counting the cookbooks in the kitchen. So I feel you on the lots of books thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We had moved. And so my office is upstairs. And so moving those books upstairs, I just realized, I was like, gosh, I gotta slow down my book.
So I can't believe this, but we're already at the last question. If you could plan your dream dinner party, who would be there? What are you eating and drinking? And keep in mind, your guest list can be living, dead, celebrity, family, like whoever in the world or the history of the world you would want to have a meal with.
That's, I, you know, this is a very difficult question. You know, I would love, one, I would love to have my great grandmother back at the table again. Just to talk, or just to hear her, just tell stories would be quite amazing. Ask her questions I should have asked her when I was younger. I would love to have her at the table. You know, I also would love to have Carla Hall at the table. I've sat down with her at the table before, and she is hilarious. So she has to be there at the table. You know, all my good chef friends, I have to be around that table. Jessica B. Harris, I would love to sit at that table. I've sat with her before, and we just ate caramels. That was a great, you know, time, and some caramels that I had made. Edna Lewis would be nice to sit at the table and ask her all the questions that I wish she could answer right now. You know, Leah Chase sitting at the table would be also be a great person. James Hemmings would be another good person to have at the table. Goodness gracious, I just go down a list of people. You know, Barack Obama has to be at the table too, girl, because we have a lot of questions for him too. You know, and Michelle, I got a lot of questions for Michelle. And Michelle, you know, throw a little Beyonce in there at the end. You know, she can make the lemonade. And let's see, you know, I'm just thinking about who would bring what to the cookout, you know. Just those opportunities just to talk about you know, Fannie Lou Hamer. I mean, there's just the impact of strong Black women that have changed my world. I would love to sit around a table and not even really to plan how we're going to conquer it, because we will, it's inevitable, but more of a fact of like, just to see how they are, just to hear their voice and to hear the dynamics of what they think our world is today, or where they think our world should be today. And, you know, and what could I do to help influence and change that to be a better place and to have a better tomorrow.
Wow. And what are you eating?
Oh my goodness. I was like, what am I eating now? I was like, oh, nothing. I ate a cookie about 2 minutes ago, but, I think it still would be Southern food. I really do. I imagine outside, I've lived all over the South. I imagine Mississippi would be a wonderful place to have it in. I imagine the willow trees, the long tables sitting outside, till it gets dark. I imagine barbecuing and smoking of meats happening, and church cakes coming out, and you know, the plethora of conversation of just sitting and enjoying each other out in a beautiful evening.
Wow. And what would you be drinking?
Red drink would definitely be there, because I would be drinking a lot of red drink, of hibiscus tea. Sweet tea would definitely have to be here. We're in the South, so that would definitely be sitting.
No unsweetened tea.
No such thing. There's no such thing. but, you know, I think it would be a lot of, you know, rooted leaf types of drinks, and the hibiscus tea definitely. I see the evening ending with like eating of tea cakes and hot tea and herbal teas, and conversations that, you know, that we are getting really mindly in depth into.
Wow. Sounds like it would go on for a bit, like people would just kind of linger and chat.
I hope so, because, you know, this is a one night thing. So, you know, you want to absorb as much as possible. Like, I just want to be there with my mouth closed and just listen, you know, other than eating, but, you know, just listening and just absorbing.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. And honestly, that describes how I feel about this conversation. Like, I've been like, just trying to absorb and listen and you know, thank you so much for being on the show. It's so great to hear you talk about your projects. And, you know, I think 40 Acres and a Mule is going to be, first of all, it's so necessary, and I think it's going to be so beautiful.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. You brought up some memories that I have not thought about in years.
Yeah, I hear like a book, honestly.
Oh,
like,
my goodness.
I know you've got a lot to do right now, but I think there's definitely like a book, and, you know, you teasing out those memories some more, because they're gorgeous.
Well, the more I think about it, I start thinking about, how does, 40 acres become part of that book? And how do I leave something that's so impactful that it will be carried on, that people can continue to do their own 40 acres, figuratively or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Many, many 40 acres in the mule, which was the original promise in the first place. So.
That's correct.
Very poetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the show, Adrienne.
Well, thank you again for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.